Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. Welcome to Bob and Yurt Live. I'm the pastor of Denver Bible Church. Some years ago, we brought to you the horrific account of a Denver Roman Catholic priest, Father Neil Hewitt, who had molested an altar boy. The boy's name was Stuart. I shared with you a handwritten letter he had penned to the priest sometime before he then committed suicide. Utterly devastating. Well, because of that series of programs, there have been developments. Some of the other victims of Father Neil Hewitt have come forward. So we're going to meet one of those other victims today. But first, I'd like to go to Donna Ballantyne, who is actually the person who made this all known, because Donna Stewart was your cousin.
Yes.
And you guys lived up in the mountains.
Yes, we did, in Leadville, Colorado.
So could you explain, let's give an overview to bring the audience up to the point where you met Michael Smolanic. Let's go back to when Stuart had committed suicide. What happened after that?
We had a memorial service in Leadville for Stuart, and I believe that was 91. And there was speculation going around that he was a victim of Neil Hewitt's, that he had been molested. It's a horrible thing to hear.
Oh, devastating. Neil Hewitt had been in the Denver metro area as part of the Denver Archdiocese.
Right.
And specifically in Aurora, I think. We'll get to that later. But then he was relocated by the church to up in the mountains. I don't mean to say it against your beautiful town of Leadville, but it's like being sent to the Russian front. Like, why was he sent to Leadville? But he was.
He was.
And so that's a question that you and I have brought to the Archdiocese. And they've refused to answer, had there been allegations, and that they were just sending him away.
Mm-hmm.
And if so, that would be horrific.
Yes.
Okay, so he had died. You had the service. There were rumors that he might have been a victim of Neil Hewitt's.
Right. It's just so unbelievable. Time passed. You forgot about it. But my mom had passed away in 2000. And after that, going through her personal effects, I found the letter that Stuart had penned to Hewitt. I knew right then. It's true.
It's a handwritten letter. We've read the letter on the air. We have set up appointments with the Archdiocese. Now, Stuart's letter is utterly devastating. And we not only have Stuart's letter, we also have other victims and witnesses that have contacted us. Of course, we'll be talking to Michael soon. Other victims. There is John who has been calling us. There is a Jamie. We're not going to give their last names, obviously. Witnesses, there's a Tom, and then there is another John. And there is an attorney in Colorado who was Stuart's girlfriend, and he had confided in her. And then she has talked to one of her clients who tells the same story. So we know about the trips to hotels, camping trips, a bogus trip to a softball tournament during which the kids only watched one or two innings of an actual softball game. So the softball tournament was an excuse. We know about a trip to Canada. That was the same trip during which they spent time in Rochester, New York. And the pornography, the alcohol, and the molestation. So all this we know from not only Stuart's letter, which is the most detailed and horrific, but also from everyone else talking to us and providing written statements of what they recollect. So we set up a meeting with the Denver Archdiocese, and you and I went, and we had one question. You recall the one question?
Well, it was a concern. What we wanted to know was he moved to Leadville because of other accusations.
Right, to get him out of the picture.
Right.
And if so, the Archdiocese would bear great responsibility because of that. It's letting loose a predator on innocent families and their children, because your cousin's father had passed away. And that's why Neil Hewitt was viewed as, what a wonderful guy. He's giving attention to this boy who needs a father figure. So we went to the Archdiocese, and they said they could not say anything unless it was to an immediate family member, a parent, a child, or a sibling.
That is right.
So what did you do then?
I took his sister there to the Archdiocese.
She lived out of state.
Yes, she did.
So we flew her in to Denver.
Correct.
We set the appointment. We went down, and the sister now asks the question, and they refused to answer.
They did.
And they would say nothing. If you remember, they're running ads on the radio saying, if you've been a victim, please come forward. What we realized was they weren't asking people to come forward so they could acknowledge and deal with the hurt and the suffering and the responsibility. They had their lawyers talk with the victims, and they were trying to minimize the risk, and that was about it. There appeared to be no contrition, no sorrow, no acceptance of responsibility, and to not tell the sister and the cousin whether or not there were accusations before Neil Hewitt molested Stewart, that is unacceptable. But that's where it ended with the Archdiocese. But then people who found those programs on the internet at our website, KGOV.com, they began contacting you.
Yes. Recently, within the last few months, I've had two victims of Hewitt contact me.
Wow. Now, let's go to Michael Smolanic, because Michael's story, it corroborates Stewart's letter, Stewart's accusations, and it's devastating, of course, in his life, in its own right. So thank you, Donna. And now, hello, Michael. Hey, Michael.
Bob, good to meet you. Well, and Donna.
Well, thank you so much, Michael. You now live in Florida, but years ago you went to a private school in Aurora.
Yeah, from 1958 to 1966, I went to St. Therese School and St. Therese Church in Aurora, Colorado.
Father Neil Hewitt, you had met him during that time.
Yeah, I'm not sure the exact time, but he stood out a lot because he was a young priest, you know, and he had a really cool car. He had a Pontiac GTO that looked really neat, and is like, and he was athletic.
From reading your account, he was very involved with the kids.
Yes, yeah, and we would always do things. You know, I don't remember him teaching the altar boys or anything like that, which I was. I don't have recollections of that, but I have recollections of doing things outside of the school, you know, like trips and things like that.
Michael, I want to talk about some of the documentation. Thank you so much for providing this, just to help us to get to know you better and confirm some of the details. So let's talk about that in a moment. But first, a couple similarities in our stories. I have not had the horrific experience you have had and so many others, but I grew up as an altar boy for years in New Jersey in Hawthorne's St. Anthony's. Mm-hmm. I went to 8 years parochial school, grammar school, we called it. But then for me, for different reasons, I felt like I got pushed out of the church. In fact, our whole family, we would go to the priest because we became very interested in the Bible, and we were told that the Bible was like mythology. It's like Greek myths.
Wow.
You don't have to believe it literally. And we thought that's just the worst thing we've ever heard. And that was from our priest. So we felt like we got pushed out. Before we get to the details of your account, did you end up turning against God with what happened to you?
Not so much God, but really the Catholic Church in my mind. You know, I did go through, you know, 1 through 9th grade. I went to Matchbuff for a year. And
that's a high school.
A high school in Denver, Catholic high school. But after the events and everything, for me, my personal trust in that church diminished quite a bit.
You lost trust in the church, but then I'm asking also, how about Jesus Christ?
I had a period where I really didn't do anything and didn't go to church. And then in high school, my sister started telling me about Bible studies at this house. And she says, oh, it's really cool. You should go. I started going with her, and it was really neat. Oh, and it was like, I really felt like the word was speaking to me, you know.
Because it's so important for people to realize that if a minister, Jesus said, many will use my name, but I don't know them. And so it's really important for people to realize that it's not Jesus Christ who has hurt them. It's others, some using his name.
Yeah. I felt when I got involved with this Bible study, it was a prayer group, and it was just very open. It was loving. Mm. And I felt closer to God than I think I ever felt in the Catholic Church. And
in high school, home Bible study, me too, the exact same thing. Coming to actually know who God is rather than just going through rituals. That happened to me in a different way than for you.
Yeah, and that's what I felt. It was like God was alive.
Yeah, isn't that awesome?
Yeah.
Know him and to love him and to not say that he's guilty.
Correct.
Because we're the ones who are guilty, not him.
Yeah.
And the victims are not guilty for what happened to them. But we've all sinned against God and we've hurt other people.
Yeah.
But he's there to forgive us.
Yeah.
It's so awesome.
And I feel like my involvement with this group and then being open to the Lord and then just really feeling like he ministered to me that, you know, I had forgiveness for many things. You know, and I think though I buried this experience deep, I think I was looking for forgiveness for, you know, to get rid of guilt and to get rid of things that I felt like I carried.
Oh, yeah, because kids feel like it's their fault somehow, typically.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's so wrong and it's so terrible. Michael, the documentation, you obviously were a student at St. Teresa's.
Yeah, and it was really important for me to bring the documentation that I'm not just saying this. It's just not an empty accusation. You know, I have my report cards.
Yeah, here's fourth grade, sixth grade, seventh grade, even plays that you were in and awards you won. Michael Smolanic, first place. Congratulations, by the way. Age 13, grade 8. And on, there's a lot of documentation here. Archdiocese of Denver, grades 1 through 3, pupil report. So thank you for all that to help us because accusations, and once we go on the radio, that's bringing the accusation to a higher level.
Yeah.
Because people, of course, put anything on the internet, which is inappropriate. If something's false, you don't do it. But then when you go on the radio, you need some corroboration. And so thank you for providing that. Now, back to your story. You said you don't remember exactly when you first met him, when you became aware of him. But what were then some of the things you did with him, some of those activities?
A number of things. You know, like I mentioned, he had that cool car. And often trips, I went to a trip to, it's called Camp St. Malo. And we camped for the weekend. I remember it clearly because I ate powdered eggs for the first time that were mixed with water.
Yeah.
Also, trips to Sterling to his parents' house.
Here in Colorado.
Yeah, out on the plains. A number of times we'd go to softball games. We would do different things. One trip involved coming home at dark, stopping at a lake or a reservoir, and skinny dipping.
Mm.
And
was it just the two of you?
No, it was me with two other kids.
Two of the kids, the boys that you reference, will only use first names?
Yeah.
Mark and Tom.
Yeah.
Were they the two at that event?
Not at Sterling.
This was two other kids. Okay.
Yeah.
And just like with Stuart in these trips, number of kids involved.
Yes.
And so over time, we've also heard from some of those who have been very hesitant, but they've wanted to maybe talk, and I've talked also to some, in addition to Donna. Of course, it's just so devastating to admit to yourself and then to speak about publicly. Yes. So there were other kids at that time with the priest saying, boys, let's go skinny dipping.
Yes, there was.
So wrong.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, and I was at that age or whatever, I was probably the only person who ever saw me naked was my mom. You know, I mean, I just a young kid, and I didn't want to be around the father. So I kind of kept off to the side and was really slow in going to the water. But there was activity where and excited voices far away from where I was at. And it ended up when they were done, when we got back in the car, the other two kids were really quiet, didn't say a word on the whole way home. And I was in the front seat, and Father had lost his glasses. Mm. And the only thing he had was his prescription sunglasses.
So it was nighttime. He lost his glasses because he had them in the reservoir.
That's what I think.
Skinny dipping. And so now he's driving you guys home, and it's somewhat unsafe.
Yeah, and I was nervous. I was watching him the whole time because he would complain, take them off for just a little bit or put them down at the end of his nose. And I was just nervous the whole ride home because I thought we were going to crash.
Sure. In the letter that you wrote September 30th,
yes,
recounting your own thoughts and recollections of what happened, September 30th, 2017, this year, you write about a book that Neil Hewitt gave you.
Yeah, that was another trip that I went on. It was a ski trip. We happened to go pick up a girl. She was probably a year ahead of me. I remember being impressed by her because she was obviously attractive. And she was older than me and real enthusiastic person. We went on a ski trip, and Father had given me this book. It's called The Herod Experiment, with just really salacious details of having sexual encounters with a lot of different partners and everything. So I was really conflicted by even looking at it. I mean, I was a teenage boy. So I had curiosity.
Well, of course. And again, this is not just inappropriate. It's immoral. It's wrong.
Yeah.
He brings the boy skinny dipping. As he's taking you on a trip, then he gives you a book to read that's salacious.
Yeah.
Sexual perversion.
Yes. Yeah. And it's so out of bounds. And for me, he was a person of trust. He was an authority figure. He was somebody that I looked up to. For him to give me these things and do these things, like skinny dipping and this
book, other things we'll talk about.
To me, it was just as like, almost like it doesn't compute in
your
mind.
No, you're conflicted, of course.
Yeah.
Absolutely, of course. This goes back to around that time, but it was in South America. There was another young priest. Something happened, Michael, that was 3 years before the trip you took with Neil Hewitt to the Expo in Montreal, Canada. But this was in Argentina in 1964. There was a young priest who was put in charge of a class of young boys. And the first assignment he gave to these teenage boys was to read the writings of an openly homosexual author. I thought that was just absolutely bizarre. And that priest today, we know him as Pope Francis. Mm-hmm. He's the Pope in the Vatican.
Wow.
And he gave those kids the writing of Garcia Lorca, who just was an open homosexual.
Mm-hmm.
Such an immoral thing to present that to these young boys. And now he has grown up to become the most homosexual-friendly Pope that there's been in the modern era.
Uh-huh.
So that's sad, but that's obviously a tangent. But during the 60s in America, homosexuals were openly welcomed in our seminaries as long as they would take a pledge of celibacy. That was the standard. And biblically, we know that's not a good standard because God made us male and female. The audience will remember we reported on that just a couple months ago.
Yeah, very interesting. The other aspect of things that I did with Father Hewitt, we went on a trip to Montreal.
Mm.
One thing that people may not know, he was a pilot. He is registered even today as a pilot. You can find it online. And we went to Montreal, Canada for the Expo 67, which was the World's Fair. I went with two other boys. They were close friends because I'd known them my whole life, Tom and Mark. We played baseball together on the same team. We lived in the same neighborhoods, and we went to Montreal.
What a thrilling opportunity to go with your buddies from Denver to Canada for the World's Fair. I mean, I went to the World's Fair in New York City when I was a kid. This is a huge, wonderful thing.
Yeah, it was very exciting. We did.
And to fly there in a private plane.
Yeah, there was four of us. I had never flown ever. I was, 15 or 14 and a half?
Yeah.
Really interesting experience. And, we did different stops along the way and then finally ended up in Rochester and
New York State.
Yeah. And then went to the World's Fair. It was in that time when Father Hewitt had made the advances on me in a hotel room there. Oh. And
write about this. It's devastating. And I know we're not going to get into salacious details, but I know also that you want people to know what happened. So we'll be very careful about how we discuss this part of what transpired.
Okay. He often encouraged different things, substance, with me, it wasn't alcohol. With me, he talked to me about stories about people are smoking banana peels to get high. And he gave me an article that had a story about, well, if you ate nutmeg, you could get high. And I was just a young kid. I liked music. So it was like the music, you know, a lot of the music groups at the time were experimenting in drugs. So I was looking up to them. So I did, you know, get some nutmeg, you know, encouraged, I feel, by Father. Ate some of this nutmeg. It tasted awful. And it didn't do anything. Nothing happened.
So that, too, is also consistent with Hewitt's behavior with Stuart Saki, although with him, he was getting these boys drunk. But a predator knows the routine, and he knows that if he breaks down the moral inhibitions of the child, that he could accomplish his ends. So to get a kid who's not thinking about getting high, to get him to think about getting high, to get him to think there's creative ways to get high, be open to trying these different sexual practices, be open to trying out what it's like to get drunk. So he's conditioning you as he conditioned other boys.
Yeah, he gave full encouragement in that area. And the peculiar thing with this event for me is that that nutmeg didn't do anything for me. But as a kid, this whole buildup about doing this, I ended up faking that I was high because I was embarrassed because I took all this stuff and it was like, I was embarrassed about it. And so,
and you didn't even have any eggnog to wash it
down. No, nothing. And so when we were in the hotel room, I was there. I was right next to the air conditioner. I shared a bed with Father Hewitt. So it was the air conditioner.
Which is so inappropriate. No, forget that word inappropriate. It is wrong for an adult man to take boys, young teenage boys, on a trip and to share a bed with one of them. It's wrong. Yeah. You know, Michael Jackson did that at his Neverland Ranch. He'd share his bed with boys.
Yeah.
And so that's just enough. There's a whole list of things that Hewitt did that crossed the line and that were conditioning these boys, breaking down their inhibitions.
Yes. Yeah.
So you were in this hotel room. There were four of you, two beds, normal hotel room configuration. You said you were near the air conditioner. Why is it you remember that detail?
I was the closest to the air conditioner and that I could see the street light coming through the window above the air conditioner. But the air conditioner was loud. So me, part of my faking this drug experience, because I was so embarrassed about, you know, it, I kept on saying, wow, is that a train? Is that a train? What's going on?
Right.
So I just did this because I was embarrassed.
How
about
did you
the
get
thing.
The nutmeg? It's one thing for him to tell you banana peels and nutmeg, but then you end up with nutmeg.
Somehow we went someplace, and I think
he made that happen.
Yeah, exactly.
He made that happen.
Yeah.
So he wanted you to get high, and
I believe so.
That's manipulators. They find people they could victimize, and those people want to meet the expectations of the predator.
Yeah. Yeah. I admired him and I had no gauge because I didn't have any experience.
Right. There's trust. That's why it's so despicable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In that time when I was doing the, making the noise and the commotion, it was then when Father Hewitt made advances on me. He touched me, inappropriately with his hands, with other parts of his body. And I didn't.
I'm so sorry, Michael. I'm just so sorry that that happened.
Yeah, I appreciate your empathy. I just everything. It's taken me. This has been buried for my whole life. With that, with what he did, there's. I trusted him and everything. And when it was happening, I wanted to escape it. I, it's like, this right. isn't, you know, for me personally, it's like I knew this isn't right. This isn't what, this has no place here. And so what I would do is I would get, I'd say, I got to go to the bathroom. And I get up and go to the bathroom. So like a huge portion of the night was me going to the bathroom to
so
say
to
I got to
escape.
Pee.
And for a kid, that's about as far as you think to escape.
Yeah.
Leaving the room and going to call the police, it's not even in the realm of possibility for the thinking of a kid who's
Absolutely.
There with an authority figure.
Exactly. You know, I would never even think of leaving the room. No. Or right. It's just like, exactly.
Right. You went to the bathroom, but you didn't really escape him doing that.
No, he kept on coming. He would come into the bathroom, and then he would kind of push on my bladder, I guess, and tell me, like, if you really had to go, you know, if you push here, you would... And it's like, no, I really have to, and then, I mean, that went on and on. I can't tell you how many trips I did, you know, but it was like, you know, I tried the best I could to shut everything down. I discouraged him as much as I could politely because, again, I trusted him.
Yes.
I had admired him, for many years before this event. So... I think that's the difficulty. I was nervous that Tom and Mark might be hearing it or something like that, and they would think that, you know, I knew it was wrong.
Yeah,
you know,
they,
it's
they
like I would be embarrassed.
You were like a willing partner.
Yeah, and that's how
You'd
I felt.
You'd be embarrassed and ashamed.
Yeah.
Right, of course.
And that's kind of...
That's the isolation. A predator takes advantage of that to keep their victims quiet.
And I felt that because my parents were very devout Catholics. They were very, you know, my dad went to a Catholic college.
Wow.
My mom, she was, you know, an honor student at the Catholic high school and very devout. And they raised us to be polite, to be respectful, and to be good Catholics. And this event, I think, really, you know, the repercussions of it just shattered that for me.
And... As a kid, you didn't want to let them down by letting them know that a priest would do this.
Yeah.
And so then as you grow up with that, you say it's been 50 years, but as you grow up with that as a kid, and it's such a dramatic thing, it makes such an impression on our psyches that then that's who I am. I'm the kid who can't tell anyone. And you grow up as that person.
Yeah.
And so it takes a lot for all the people who've broken through that.
Yeah. This is an aside, but, you know, people may wonder, well, why are you telling us this now? And it's like, you know, my dad passed away at 95 just this summer, and he was kind of like the last one, as well as my mother-in-law, who was a devout Catholic as well. And I feel like with them not being able to be disappointed in their faith, I feel like I can personally... share this now.
It freed you.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And I think we want to accomplish a couple things here. Anyone in the audience who has been hurt as a child, who has been molested by a man or a woman, and if it's in a church setting especially, whether Protestant or Catholic, but of course the Catholic Church has had an epidemic of male priests molesting boys. If you've been hurt, it's understandable that you have not told anyone, if you haven't, but it's really important for you and for justice and accountability to come forward if you're able to. And if you think you can't, go to the Lord. Ask God for the courage, for the strength to share with others and with the authorities what has happened to you.
Yeah, and that is a great point, Bob, and I really think it's going to be harder for some of those people. I mean, I didn't really admit to anyone. My first person I admitted it to was my wife, and it was after we saw the movie Spotlight.
Mm.
We came home, and in the kitchen, we were both standing there, and I told her the story. I just told her that a Catholic priest did that to me.
Oh,
she was the first person. That was
oh, my.
When the movie first came out.
Wow.
She was the first person. So admitting that there... This has been on my mind for a number of years. You have to process it, and you have to find, because a lot of trust has been broken, I think you have to find situations where you feel that trust. And I'm just so thankful that KGov has on their website these stories from 2004 that I found.
Yes. Michael, there is more. Would you be able to do a second program with us?
Yes, to make sure that everything is covered.
Okay.
I would really appreciate it. Really, thanks.
Well, thank you. It's an honor to have you here and Donna, and to seek justice for all the victims of Neil Hewitt, and especially Stuart. So I look forward to that program. Tune in tomorrow, either broadcast KLTT in Denver or online at KGOV.com. May God bless you.